Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. This is the second part of the Cliff High interview that I did. I love talking to Cliff High. He is so much fun. I love diving into these issues that are out there, and his brain will go there and he'll think about this stuff, and it's really entertaining. And I love talking to him about all this. It's based on his predictive linguistics work that he does. And whether you believe the average person is psychic or not, which he does, it really does show what trends are going on and possible trends that are going on by looking at the changes of emotions. Whether you believe it's based on psychic abilities or not, there is something to all this. And it's so much fun to talk about. And I can tell that other people love it as well, because the YouTube views on the first part of this show got, it's up at like 130,000 right now. Awesome how many people are viewing it and liking it. So hopefully you will like this as well. And if you didn't hear the first part, go to my webpage at sarahwestall.com and you can get access to all of that and all my past shows. And if you're liking the material that I'm putting together, please go to patreon.com under Sarah Westall and support the show. Even the littlest amount would be great, and it helps the show and covers our costs. So let's get into that interview now with Cliff High.
And we could do it with, modern day tools, but it'd take you a long time and it's probably not worth the effort anyway.
Well, I know China's been working on it for a long time. They're trying to correct that cryptocurrency, the SHA.
256. Yeah. Well, okay, you hear people talking about that, and I've seen a lot of attribution of some of these Chinese firms as being involved in that, and some Chinese individuals that are being involved in that. And as near as I can tell, I don't think they're actually doing that. I think they're trying to find a replacement, the next grade up, see, their own version of that, if you will, because the encryption is highly valuable. On the internet, extremely valuable. And if you can come up with a very fast, secure form of a new kind of a hash that is, it has to have all these characteristics, memory efficient, space efficient, and so on. But if you can get that, it's worth billions and billions of dollars. It would be the next blockchain, so to speak, right? And that is a limitation. It takes a long time to do hashing effectively on lots of rows. And that's what the blockchain computers are competing around, is basically how fast they can do that.
Yeah. Well, do you see world governments moving towards cryptocurrencies? As the dollar here is collapsing and needing to reset, could that be the long-term goal of governments to just kind of move us into a cryptocurrency gently? I don't know, gently. But
I actually think I'm of the opinion it's the wild strain. I don't think it may have been created in government, but it's gotten out from their control. I don't think that the powers that be like it. They're very much afraid of where it leads, because it's the return of power to the people. And bear in mind, anybody can set out and create their own cryptocurrency. There's nothing to stop you. Whereas before, if you created your own dollar bill, hey, they'd call it counterfeiting. They did it. They created their own dollar bills out of nothing. But if you do it, it's unfair somehow, and so you have to go to jail. Well, that's not the case anymore, and they can't put that cat back in the bag. This is a particularly nasty cat. It's going to fight them the whole way, and it just isn't going to work on this case because it's out there already. And so, no, I'm not of that opinion. I think they're playing catch-up. I think it's far too late, and we're on our way anyway. But I don't really think it was their idea, no. The powers that be are laggards, really.
Well, they liked their game, right? So
yeah,
they would rather
yeah.
maintain their game than do something that's really risky by taking on a new...
Yeah.
Well, okay, so I think you're in your element here. I was reading through your cryptocurrency things. I could just tell this is Cliff's element. You love this stuff. You had a whole bunch of things on blockchain. There's a whole new, everything. It's an explosion of things that are happening. Could you go down some of the coolest things that are happening with blockchain and some of the things that you talk about in your newest report?
Boy, there is so much of it there.
The just blockchain a couple of your favorites.
Yeah. A couple of the interesting ones, and I don't know if my favorite at the moment, of course, is Ethereum, because they're about to get ever so much faster. And the Ethereum network is a platform upon which people like myself can write code and structure businesses. And so there are the couple of really cool businesses that I know of that are running on blockchain. And I did interviews with both of the CEOs. One is Populous and the other is Veritasium. Both of these are run by two different mindsets entirely. One guy approaching it from the Populous guy is approaching disintermediation of an existing industry via technology. And that's Steve Nico Williams. And then Reggie Middleton in Veritasium is taking technology, a different level of technology, to disrupt any business that they aim at. And so both of them are going to be world-changing in their own ways. And at some point, I expect both of these cryptocurrencies to be worth more than the underlying cryptocurrency of Ethereum, which is the platform upon which they run. So it's kind of like Ethereum would be the big department store, and Populous, it would be the bank inside the department store.
Or Starbucks inside of Target.
Correct. Exactly. And they might end up generating more money than the store around them, you know, just because of their draw. And that's exactly what's going to happen with a bunch of these cryptos, especially based on the Ethereum network. Now we're going to also have competition to Ethereum networks, and that'll make it even better. And we're seeing it bust out in a lot of different ways. A strange one I really like is this a couple of Russian companies. One is doing coins around sand. Buckets of sand. If you buy one of their coins, it entitles you to present the coin at their sand distribution place and get 3 cubic meters of some of the finest sand that you can find in Russia. And, you know, people look at me, well, you know, okay, what's going on there? But the thing is, Russia is in the process of building out their section of the One Belt, One Road initiative from China. And this is the largest continental railroad system that has ever been created. Absent CERN, it will be the largest amount of money invested in a continent-wide machinery base. And they've just started. This thing is going to be thousands upon thousands of miles of train tracks, and not just one train from Beijing to Berlin, but all of these train tracks, all these different spur lines and other connections and so on. They're just beginning this, and we can think of this as the build-out of the intercontinental freeway system in the U.S., which took decades. Well, we're looking at decades worth of production as they build out the One Belt, One Road system from Beijing through to Berlin. And every aspect of it needs sand. So the sand coin is pretty good, in my opinion. And it's strategically located near Moscow, where they're going to have a lot of the headquarters of this stuff that has to be built as well. So these guys are going to do well with their sand.
Well, it's kind of like the cryptocurrencies that are based on metals too, right? I mean, it's that same concept. And if you have an underlying commodity underneath it that's really in demand.
There's the problem, though. See, here's the thing. The sand is going to be used up. And so you present the coin, they redeem it, and so on. And okay. The sand gets used up. The system with gold is different. And that's why I'm not in favor of any of the gold-backed systems I've seen so far, because they all rely on your ability, me trusting Sarah's ability, to keep all of our gold safe. And
Well, we know how that goes.
Exactly. And big government comes along and says, well, wait a second. Sarah's sitting over there on a bunch of gold we could use. Let's convict her of a crime, or even just charge her with a crime and go snatch all that gold, and then they can fight us to get it back. And there's nothing we can do about it from the cryptocurrency side of things, right? So I'm not a big fan of any of the metals where the idea is to vault the metal. Not only do you have the trust issues involved, but you got constant cost involved and that kind of thing. And it's working now within the fiat system from some places like gold money, where you can buy gold and spend it on your credit card and that kind of thing. The ones I do favor, though, are the ones that are involving themselves with silver and acting as a price stability mechanism and a conduit to get silver to manufacturers. So I'm aware of a couple of cryptocurrencies that are going to be out early next year whose goal will not be the storing of silver at all, but it will be to provide burgeoning silver mines with the funding to get the silver out of the ground. And the idea is that these coins would in the main be sold to the manufacturers and would be redeemable by silver delivered to the manufacturer. So it's not really a silver-backed coin, because the coin itself is not in any way a security, because the coin is actually there to cover the energy costs of getting the silver out of the ground, and then the profit is built within that coin.
So do you think that will be a means to helping silver get out from underneath this huge suppression? Because
yes.
The suppression is incredible.
Dominating. Yeah.
I mean,
it's terrible.
It seems like it's so low that the actual miners can't make money.
Correct.
Is it below manufacturing costs?
In many areas, it is. And that's going to be a function of the amount of energy required to get this stuff out of the ground and the local tax structure and how much they have to pay for overhead. And so the ICOs, see, this is the beauty of it all. We've hit this huge level of efficiency. For these silver mines to raise money in the dollar and debt system, they would have to basically go through all of the machinations involved in heading towards an IPO, whether they ever got there or not, right? And the cost involved would be much higher than the underlying product is. Here, with the efficiency of the ICOs, you can raise millions of dollars quite easily in the matter of an afternoon once you open up your initial coin offering, once you've got everything set up. So it might take you a couple of months to put all the software together, check it out, get it set up, but it's not rocket science. It's been done before. There's a number of different schemes, and you're funded. And you can put that money into an escrow account. You can have it sit in a number of different ways to use over time so the customers are protected. I've even come up and put it on my site, a scheme that would allow companies to have a performance bond with a buyback smart contract that would enable 100% confidence, because you wouldn't lose money below a certain level of the fiat you put in. And you can do all of this at a small fraction of the cost, about 2.5% to 3%. Of the cost involved. So that's not much in overhead. And it means that now we don't have to have that 50%+ going to the banks and the bonuses. Thus, we'll be able to buy more sand. So cryptos are the way to go. I mean, it's the wave of the future. More companies are just deciding to hell with funding any other way.
Well, yeah, because it seems, right now, everybody's trying to hedge their bet on what's going on with the market, when to get out, when to just dive into other things. And I suppose once that threshold, kind of like the tipping point, once enough people get out of the dollar, then it dies, right?
Right, right.
And we're just waiting for when that tipping point is going to happen.
I'm not. I don't care anymore. I'm so moved into cryptos, you know, and so much into that world, and so many of the people I know, that it is it's truly no longer much of a concern for me.
As far as it the upheaval of society.
Right. And I actually think the cryptos are probably going to save us. Okay. Because had we hit that hard wall, as we know, the Rothschild Bank, the Economist, owns the Economist magazine. As we know, in 1988, they put out a cover that said in 2018, the Rothschild gold standard comes along, the Phoenix, the emblem of the Rothschild, the fleur-de-lis, all of this stuff. And we're going to dominate the world with a gold standard. Well, that's not going to happen now. All right. It just can't happen. It was stupid to begin with. Had it happened, millions of people would have died, because our just-in-time delivery system would have 100% failed as we attempted to gear back up into liquidity to provide that, since most of it all runs on debt and credit anyway. And now that won't be necessary, because we'll have crypto funding going along side by side on this thing. And so increasingly, it is becoming more and more common to be able to use your cryptos where dollars used to do. And a lot of people now could not tender a cryptocurrency for rent or a mortgage payment. But in the future, that necessarily won't be a limitation. And once we've gotten to that level, then it's like, who cares if there's a dollar, if you can take your Ether coin or your Litecoin or whatever and go in and buy your Starbucks or, you know, use it at the grocery store or whatever. It no longer matters to you. And if you're using a plastic credit card-like device, you're familiar with that. You know how all that works. No big deal, you know.
Well, do you think slowly companies are just going to move towards it? You think all of a sudden overnight companies are going to start paying you in Bitcoin or Ethereum?
I think it's going to be like any other technological adoption, okay? So if you've ever been in a large organization, you're way too young. So you would have grown up with computers, all right? But I've been in organizations that were no computers, and then we had to bring in computers to 100,000 employees, and we had less than 13 months to do it. And this is a staggering task, because people are not prepared. Many people just quit their jobs rather than learn new trade because they were 50 or 60 years old and they could take retirement and get out. So we're going to have that kind of an effect as the technology goes through the social order. However, because it's such a vital technology, everybody's going to have to get it, and you'll find the grandkids helping the grandmother get the hang of the cryptos and how to spend them and this kind of thing, because it'll be necessary. And then once they're familiar with it, it sort of, you know, fades mm-hmm. into the background.
It's kind of like that commercial where the grandkids come to visit grandma and grandpa and they hand them all their computers to fix it. I think that's
I haven't seen that, but the concept's good. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I have another question for you from one of our listeners. This relates to the Rothschilds. It's into just weird stuff. Adnan Sackley, if I'm pronouncing that right, was reported as the richest man in the world by Inc. and a few other magazines in Europe. Never reported in the United States. And then suddenly he's missing. Are you familiar with that situation?
What is that? There's a whole lot of unanswered questions there. Okay, so I'm familiar with the situation, and I know that there's just hole after hole after hole that you can go into, and there's no depth beyond that. So I think that the situation there is relatively being scrubbed or suppressed. That at this stage, I think we need to wait a little bit. There's got to be a break one way or another, because something of that some person of that magnitude doesn't simply disappear. Especially with all of the business interests and this kind of thing, they're not easily subsumed. So it would be akin to, the king and queen and the whole royal family going missing, that kind of thing.
Well, and the weird part is nobody in this country even knows who the guy is.
That I don't find so weird. I don't know, because our media is so controlled and they've got us so focused, you know. And if you're in the United States.
We're that controlled where the richest man in the world is different in another country than it is here.
Yeah.
So bizarre. Well, look, you know, you have to admit it is that bizarre.
Okay, but if you want proof of it, go and look at any major national magazine in our country, and you'll see that there's international editions, and those international editions don't look like what they're showing here.
Well, no, and I know, because when I dug into this guy, I got copies of the other magazines, and that's what, it's like, okay, you know, this is real. It's weird.
Right.
I'll put it up so people can see the front page of the magazine, how it differs here and there.
And also, though, too, we have to be careful about saying who's the richest and all of this, simply because it's an issue of how you tabulate wealth. Because
yes.
there are people in India that technically are don't own anything at all, but are in control of probably far more wealth and thus, in essence, own it than even the Rothschilds.
Wow, interesting. I haven't heard of it like that. But the Rothschilds and the really wealthy people aren't even on the list, right?
They won't allow that. They own the list.
Yeah, it's not happening. I'm not being on the list.
Right.
Okay, well, let's get into some flipping amazing things that is not in your report this time. I'm sure it's going to be in other ones. Antarctica.
Yeah.
There's amazing stuff going on there. What have you learned recently about that?
There's basically three tracks there. I mean, we weren't able to get your kid his job as a welder down there to be our spy. Okay, so, but there are people down there that are new hires that have been in contact with me, and a couple of people that have just recently come from there that have finished their contracts that are talking to me.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about. I'm sure there's so many people down there, they're going to start talking. So
yeah, that's the cool part. And hey, they've laid their second fiber optic bundle from Brazil to Antarctica. Uh-huh. Now, that's a huge undertaking for even one of them. And they've laid the second one there.
Okay.
And these bundles, reputedly, I can't say, I've only been told this, but these fiber optic bundles are reputedly the widest bandwidths ever created. And so they're the biggest, so to speak, in terms of diameter. So we know those penguins are demanding that they get that high-speed internet, because they're, you know, why else would you have the need for this?
Well, it's just a huge investment. So.
Correct. Giant investment. Well, also, okay, so we know that this is occurring. I was put onto this by a guy who actually worked on one of the ships that did the laying of the cable. I went and validated that the contracts that existed, that they've done this. And then in the process of doing that, I also found out how to validate some level of the monies involved in food shipments for some of the contingents down there. And they're now shipping food basically monthly for an annual kind of a population, not a seasonal population where most of them would go home before winter sets in and leaving a few hardy souls. Now they've got very large populations down there to the extent that they're hiring people like massage therapists and physical therapists for especially for damaged hands and stuff, or
okay,
hand repair, that kind of thing. They're hiring these people, and these people are going to be there on multi-year contracts, and they get a vacation. But basically, they're working there, you know, 24/7 for a year, that kind of a deal. Whereas before, they might sign up for 3 or 4 months in the summer and then be gone. So conditions have changed. And now so that's at that level that we have that going on. Then we also have the issue of the science that's being released that they're willing to talk about. So they're willing to talk about the giant chunk of ice that broke off. And then a few weeks later after that, they say, hey, look, we've discovered, you know, acres and acres and acres of volcanoes that are rapidly melting the ice, much more so than we had thought. Whereas before we thought there were 11 or 19 or something. Now we know there's 60 or 500. I mean, a huge increase in the number. And they're all active and spewing like mad underneath the ice and melting it and this kind of thing. And so now there's an admission that the ice is going away, that the topology or the climate of the area is changing without it being global warming. So it's going to be kind of hard for them to maintain that Antarctica is going to become ice-free when the global warming story goes away later in this year and most of us are suffering from the first part of the ice age. The two are not connected, by the way. You can have an ice age without having your poles covered by ice. We're not talking snowball Earth. We're talking ice age around the land masses. Anyway, so there's that about the changes down there. There have also been some current changes. And we saw this recently. I don't know that it's 100% related, but at the same time that I became aware of the current changes through this little chunk of Antarctica is not actually a whole continent. It's basically a giant area and then a sort of an island archipelago area. Mm. And I actually think there's been some kind of undersea connection now between the East and the West oceans. Mm. Bear in mind that there's a difference between the Atlantic and the Pacific of 6 inches in height. Okay, the Atlantic is 6 inches lower than the Pacific overall. This is where they meet. Traditionally, was the Sea of Storms off the Patagonia, right? The rounding of the Horn and on either Africa or South America was deadly, and that's because the oceans were trying to work out this difference. Well, the other day, it was reported that in Uruguay and Brazil, the oceans drained away in a way that was so shocking and in a tidal episode that people there thought they were about to be hit by a giant tsunami because it drained away so far from the traditional beach. And that may have been, coincidentally, the same time that this whatever connection I suspect existed or was created came into existence that now allows the flow of water between the oceans at a subsurface level.
So now is it permanently away from Brazil's beach? Or did it come back?
It had come back, but it took an exceptionally long time. And when it was away, it was several hundred yards out from the base of the sand where the ocean usually would be. So all of the luxury hotels that
were
right on the beach.
They're
all freaking out. They actually got all their people up and everybody went up thinking it was going to be a tsunami that would take out the bottom couple of floors. And they reacted very badly. But you had giant ships sitting in the mud because it drained out that rapidly. So it sort of seemed like a tsunami. And then it just took forever to come back. So there was some kind of an effect that was mitigated or magnified by the tides. And it happened all along the coast of Brazil and Uruguay. I've got some questions down to some people that are on the opposite side of South America to see if there was any impact on Peru, et cetera, right? And we'll find out in the next couple of days when these guys get back to me because they're going to go talk to some coastal fishermen there.
If we had any kind of resemblance of real news, this would be, you know what I mean? Yeah. This would be covered.
Well, in Brazil it was.
Not cover it there.
Right, right. So that's related to Antarctica, is my understanding. I mean, I can show you my funky little globe here, but because they didn't think anybody ever cared about Antarctica, they've got all the metal bits go right through the South America to hold it there. And so you can't really see it. But if you look at a map of Antarctica, you can see that there's this little chunk that sticks out. And I actually think down at the base of that chunk under the ice, there's now a connection between the two oceans. And if I'm correct, it would have naturally occurred as a result of the ice being cracked off, which called this other piece to rise up, and the volcanic pressure in that area providing the hot water to sort of clear off the last of it. And if I'm correct, then the effect of that will be this equalization of the height levels of both oceans over the course of a relatively short period of time. It may result in fewer storms in the southern seas, a lot of which was
calmer
driven
waters.
Calmer waters, correct.
Yeah, because they don't have that level difference. It'll start to level out.
Right. And it's going to be really, really strange here as well because of the potential for new flow from basically the east side of Antarctica to the west side. And so they should have new creatures and all different kinds of stuff going on.
That's really interesting. So,
but
okay,
for us, we won't see that. We won't see that part of it.
But it's still really neat. Okay. So do we think... You said there was technology that they found in Antarctica, which...
Well, I was just getting to that. I was just getting to that.
Okay, I wasn't going to let you forget that part.
This is the cool part. Okay, so I'll give you a guy who has video of it online. This is a guy, Dabu077.
Is it on YouTube?
He's on YouTube.
Okay, I'll make a connection to that.
Okay, and he's one of maybe a dozen others that are out there doing these things. What they're doing is they're basically watching various different kinds of satellites that feed us data down here, and they are they're recording it, these satellite feeds. So you can watch SOHO, a solar observatory online. Just put in SOHO and you get pictures of the sun. And if you wanted to run a recording program, you could record what you're watching. And they're doing that, and they're catching stuff coming out of Antarctica. And so Dabu 7 has caught one or two or three of these episodes of these, what I'm calling a cannon, sort of a ray gun cannon that is being shot out of Antarctica. And the best example he's got comes from what I think is like the Weddell Sea part of Antarctica. And it goes across the southern hemisphere and rises up from the equator and exits our atmosphere somewhere over Hawaii at about 19.5 degrees north.
So it goes in a straight line and then it goes up?
No, it goes in a straight line leaving the planet.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because our planet's round. Yeah.
Correct. So it's going in a straight line. So it's not changing its trajectory or anything. And it's a series of pulsed rings that are obviously held within this ray or part of the ray. And the rings themselves are visible within that ray, and you can see the disturbance in the clouds and everything within the widening part of the ray itself. And this is a giant thing to be able to span that distance of our planet. Bear in mind, it's spanning, it's shooting this ray out, and the ray doesn't disappear, it keeps going into space for all we know, but it's covering over a third of our planet in the process of shooting this ray out. So that would be like the equivalent of you being able to take your water hose, so to speak, and fire it several hundred miles with your thumb on the end of it, that sort of a thing. I mean, it just, the energy involved is just phenomenal. These people are spanning over a third of the planet with this one. And I've seen three captures of it. Dabu-7 has got one of the better ones. It's been shooting off intermittently here.
So it's the underlying energy that's flipping amazing.
Yeah, and there's other parts of it. There's other weirder ones too, okay, that maybe it's the same device misfiring. It may be the same device, the exhaust from it, we don't know. But there have been these weird little bloopy sort of energy waves that go out of Antarctica over to South Africa. And those are not at the same time as the ones that have fired over Hawaii, but they're within a couple of days of it. Every single time, it's within a couple of days following. And so I don't know if it's a test, if they've got to clear out the tube or whatever the hell is going on down there. Now, our data sets, still polluted by the blue chicken stuff, so I'm still working on that. But they are pointing out that these things are a guidance system. And so... One of the the two rays that you're able to see, the two examples I've cited here, are entirely different. The one that goes towards Africa is not at all like a ray. It curves. It wanders off. It almost seems more physical. There appear to be balls in it as opposed to the rings, the smoke ring effect that you see in the other one. So they're different. And one of them is being called a guidance system within our data sets. And so but on the other one, we have the word for sentinel and guard and sentry and stationary and all of these kind of things showing up. So maybe it's a weapon system. Maybe it's like a planetary weapon system, that kind of thing. And the data would suggest that that's ancient. The data also suggests that someone turned the on switch. You know, hey, does this thing still work?
And it works.
We don't know. And I can't trust the ancient part because I have yet to get to that language. And that language still has some level of pollution from the blue chicken guys. So I don't trust that ancient part. But what I do trust is the guidance system part and then the sentinel part, the ray gun aspect of it, and many of the other descriptors.
Well, the weird part is if it's from us, why isn't it happening in Antarctica? Why wouldn't it be happening in different places, you know, some real high-level security place in, you know, United States or wherever?
Well, because they don't want Sarah to know about it. And where else to put it? You never go down to Antarctica. They haven't seen you there in years. And so
they've never seen me there.
Well, and see, that's the point. That's the point. And so, you know, you can do a lot of stuff in Antarctica that you can't do any other place on the planet because there's not many people to see it.
But they're doing it as a world event.
That's kind of, and I don't know that they know that we know. They probably do pretty quick because there's a lot of people talking about it now, but they may have been unprepared for it leaving traces in the satellites that they had up there looking at us anyway, right? They may not have known that it was going to do this. You hit the switch and you see that, you know, it's sitting there vibrating or whatever it does. And then you, if this was the guidance system, well, okay, it looks like it's doing fine. And you don't know that it's sending out all these waves that, you know, leave a visible trail in the infrared or something, right?
But the weird part is they're doing this as a collective world effort, right? I mean, Brazil's putting this huge thing, or is it not? Is it just Brazil's doing?
I can't determine.
You don't know.
I don't know. I know we've got a lot of individual companies down there within the Western Empire. The companies are coordinated by the deep state. That's a good assumption to make that the deep state's behind it. Globally, there are a lot of deep states involved in Antarctica.
Deep state is international.
Right. And so maybe indeed it is being done at a world level, but I don't think it's at a visible world level. They don't want us to know about it. I'm quite sure.
Well, now do you think... because there's more stuff being uncovered with all these volcanoes. Do you think it maybe is us in a past time where we were much more advanced, you know, in the world in collisions? Like I just did a interview with Wallace Thornhill. Absolutely fabulous on the electric universe and what we were before and how advanced we were before. Very interesting. And all the architecture that's our archaeology that's coming out around the world, you know, showing that. Now, is that us in an advanced state or is it alien technology or a combination of two?
I won't put anything down to alien technology until we actually see them critters, okay? Because it takes away from us and we're really smart. Humans have really screwed it up and we are the remnants, you and I, all right? We're the remnant culture. In the past, there have been at least seven other cultures that have been advanced enough to have nuclear weapons and or their equivalent. Because we've got huge areas in the Sahara where these cities were hit by nukes and glazed over, and in India even. And so I know that we existed,
and
humans.
That's scary. Because
that is scary. That we've screwed it up before.
and a lot of times.
Yes, exactly.
Screwing it up this time is very possible.
Exactly. But also, so at this stage, we know that that is true, that humans go back millions of years, and it's a bunch of BS from the academic viewpoint that humans crawled out of the caves 40,000 years ago. Archaeology proves that if it was not us, then it was something, the archaeology shows us that we go back a long, 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 long way, but there may be something before us that was there. We know that there was something before us, the giant megalithic structures that we have no way of moving that stone now. They're stones so large that are cut and chiseled, and they're not even chiseled. They're finely machined, purposely built, replicated, you know, several different dozens of them. And each of these stones are so big, we do not have cranes or helicopters that could lift them up and stand them up.
I'll put a little picture here. I have one on my website of this huge pillar, and there's little tiny people on it, and it's still sitting in the quarry.
Yeah, exactly. And it, unmoved, but somebody had moved the two others that were side by side to it. And we don't know where they are. Yeah. So some of that stuff was really going on, and that was not humans. Now, we also know that there were giants on this planet, giant humanoids. We know that the giant humanoids existed as late as the 1912. Okay. Because prior to 1912, prior to the degradation of Russia, the Tsar actually paid for Cossacks to go on giant hunts through the late 1800s.
Wow.
And they found and killed individuals that they would bring back. And one guy, they brought him back, desiccated basically a big bag of bones, took him several years to do. And when they weighed the bones, this one hominid who was over 30 feet high, his bones weighed over 4,000 pounds.
Wow. Well, they found bones all over the place. They used to put it in newspapers. But it's like it's all been scrubbed. It's really weird.
No, it's the Smithsonian. Okay, the Smithsonian Institution is the largest false flag ever created. It's the most well-organized, well-funded false flag ever in existence. It's the greatest training ground for the closed minds of these individuals that are in charge that I've ever seen. Okay, because there are people that will go to the Smithsonian, and in the Smithsonian's own records are records of, you know, so-and-so working for them doing this. And yet if I call them up and ask, well, did so-and-so from the Smithsonian ever go to the Grand Canyon? And they say, no, he never even worked for us. And yet we've got all these newspaper records that, you know, identify this from the period.
But why? Why are they so hell-bent on keeping us in the dark and something that just doesn't seem like it needs to be in the dark? You know, I know religion ties in and stuff, but why? Even in the Bible, I talk about giants.
Right, exactly. And here's the thing. If they actually were trucking around like that, and if you admitted that indeed the world is not as academia would have it, then why would you believe any of the stuff they're saying? Why would you accept that the Queen of England theoretically owns 1/5 of the planet and all the people that live on it? You know, or any of this kind of stuff, right? I mean, you would just disregard any of the, but that comes from the perspective of suddenly being pushed into the real knowledge that giants existed and that there were hominids, that they were cannibalistic relative to our species and that they ate us and all these different kinds of things.
Well,
if
they ate us, then there maybe we didn't want them around.
Well, there is that, see, and there's Native American myths here, and we even have them up here in the Pacific Northwest of the Native American myths of the giants. Now, they were something that had to be hunted down, and basically you stayed away from them. But if they got too close to the tribe, then the tribe would have to make plans to deal with these individuals because they didn't want to be prey. And it's really what the situation was. Now, there's all kinds of FUD around this, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and obfuscation, because everybody, you know, for instance, the Masonic lodges. These days, the Masonic lodges are relatively innocuous, but throughout the late 1800s into the 1900s, as they were rebuilding Mason structure here in the United States, they had the Masons in charge of basically being the carriers for the Smithsonian. So the Masons were the ones that moved all the bones off of the giants off of the islands in Catalina, put them on fishing boats and Navy boats and took them out to sea and dumped them. That was true all along the West Coast here. Whenever they found bones of giants, it would be the local Masonic lodge that would be in charge of the removal of the bones. And many of these were, quote, sent to the Smithsonian, but we also know the Smithsonian for years ran a giant dumping operation out of Roanoke, Virginia. And that was their headquarters for disposing all of the stuff at sea that they didn't want to see around. And they were trying to scrub and maintain a particular view of history to support the ruling classes and the power structure. Now, why the power structure chose that, I don't know. I can't go to their intent. I think it's really damaged humanity, but I also think it's now really cool for us because all this stuff's going to be coming out over these next few years. The reason it's going to come out is pretty soon nobody will be able to afford the salaries. They won't pay the salaries at the Smithsonian. And boy, talk about people crawling out of there with stuff to sell.
Oh, so that's an example of people crawling out of the holes with information.
And
I'm excited for that.
Oh, won't it be cool? I'll get on eBay. I'll bid on some of that stuff.
It's so exciting. It's like suddenly a whole like cloud is going to be lifted.
And it's going to be a shock. You know, you're going to get sunburned and there's going to be, you know, information burn and people are going to go crazy trying to reconcile it and this sort of thing. But nonetheless, we've got to go through that. And it's necessary. They've held us in stasis too long.
We do need it. It's important for us to know the real facts, because otherwise go ahead.
I say, I don't know that it's important for us to know the real facts, but I know that it is desperately important for us to be able to have the freedom to go and look for them, you know, to go and speculate about them and not be shut down. So I find it is the push, the emotion for the exploration that is important, whether we're ever successful, because you'll always debate about fact, right?
You're right with that. The not being suppressed. I like that. I like that the facts themselves aren't as important as not being suppressed and trying to figure out what the facts are.
Yeah. Yeah. Those bastards, you know, keeping us down and keeping the information and we paid for it. You know, I've worked on this planet for, 50 plus years here. And it's like, wow, how much of my labor went to pay for all these bribes, the corruption, the hauling the bones out, all of that kind of stuff, you know?
Well, you don't want to get me started. The trillions and trillions that are missing that we really should get back so that we could have a prosperous, you know, we can just get out of debt and move forward.
I don't want them back. Okay. And I don't want them back because I want the stuff they paid for.
Because
we
assets.
Need that. We need that more than we need the debt and the dollars.
Well, I don't think we're going to get the dollars back anyways. You're going to get the...
that's
we're going to get... Yeah.
Yeah, but I want one of those little floaty triangle bastards, you know, and I'd bid on eBay for that too.
With all your Bitcoin money once you become a multimillionaire. Well, or maybe you are already. I don't know. Okay, so you were talking about the Dogon.
Yeah.
And I thought that was absolutely fascinating. And I've been, you know, listening to them a little bit. People that Large Stratton, I think it is what his name is. He actually studied them for a long time. Want to get him on my show. But you studied them too. Can you tell us a little bit about who they are and why they're important?
The Dogon are actually a very minor tribe in Africa. They were at one point their own nation. How large, I can't say, but there's records that show that the Dogon people were more nationalistic in the past than they are now. They were pushed around by circumstance and other tribes. They moved from Kenya up into the area that they're in now, which is Mali. And they're presumed to have migrated over from Egypt. All right. There is indeed some level of knowledge that came over, but there's actually more genetic history showing that they came from further south in Africa. Neither here nor there, but they ended up in Mali, where they encountered some Frenchmen at the very early part of the century. And these were French archaeologists. And one of them happened to ask this guy, actually two people in the Dogon tribe, about their creation myths. And that led the Dogon to spewing out all this kind of information that was written down by these French guys, and much of which was considered to be extremely fanciful and, you know, made up, so to speak, and so on. But now it turns out to be provable, factual, and this kind of thing. So, for instance, the Dogon told the Frenchmen in 1928 or 32 that, well, Sirius is not a star. Sirius is a cluster. That there's three major components of Sirius, Sirius A, B, and C. He didn't call them that. And that Sirius C, even though it is the smallest of all of these, is the most interesting because that's where the Nummo come from. And that Sirius C is a star that is so small that we represent it here with the smallest grain that we have found in Africa. And it's this little tiny seed that they use. And they use this as comparison. This seed to this other seed is the ratio, exact ratio they claimed, between Sirius C in Sirius A in terms of the star's mass. And so they held out these two seeds and the Frenchman writes it all down. And then 15, 20 years later, science says, hey, Sirius isn't a star, it's a star cluster. And there's actually three groups and that they're separated by this distance, something that the Dogon also said was that the spacing between Sirius presented it as a single platform for us, but Sirius C was much further back than Sirius A or B from our perspective. And so everything that they knew about this far distant star cluster turns out to be accurate and invalidated, even to the point where they can now say that the Sirius C star, in terms of its relationship to the Sirius A star, is exactly this proportion of the small seed to the large seed. And they had all this, it was orally transmitted, and this was just part of this incredible ancient knowledge base that these guys have, that they've maintained. And within that knowledge base is the knowledge of the Nummo, or Nummo, and their an aquatic species that the Dogon say came and created us and created humanity and also created most of the life as it exists currently on the planet, both in the oceans and on the Earth, on the terrestrial part. And the Nummo legends we find are replicated throughout all cultures in antiquity. So if we go and we dig up stuff in Mesoamerica, we find representations of these little aquatic beings that have sort of mermaid kind of features in a way. They're pretty ugly from our perspective. That's something that's common in all of them, is that none of these Nummo are what we would think of as pretty creatures. And the ugliness, the type of ugliness in the faces and so on is replicated by all the people that carved them, and whether they carved them into stone or created them out of clay or whatever. We find this all around the planet, northern and southern hemisphere, and we find the myth, the linguistics that the Dogon have replicated in a lot of the linguistics up here in the Pacific Northwest with the Puget Sound Salish and the Coastal Salish, not so much the inland tribes. And we also find that myth goes all the way up into the Dinglet in Alaska, and then all the way down into Polynesia, Melanesia, and Micronesia, all the way over to the Maori. And so the creation myth in the Pacific area is as pure as is the creation myth as it's described by the Dogon, because it's been unpolluted by lots of people going through, because not a lot of people stop by all these islands, so the myths have a tendency to stay pretty clean. And basically the story is that the Nummo came here. They found a planet that had water and some cool stuff. They took some of the DNA. They go off and they create a few things. And one of the things they create, this is what they do. Okay, they're into genetics. This is just how the Nummo roll. This is their whole thing. And they're an interesting being. They're an aquatic being. They're immortal and eternal. We are merely eternal. We're not immortal. They're immortal because they could take their, what we would think of as their consciousness and their soul, and birth those through their own body into a new being. And as they gave birth to one being, that would be them in that new body.
It'd be like a snake almost shedding its skin, except this is a whole body.
Sort of, yes, very much. It's especially at the consciousness level, you're quite correct. Okay, and it'd be a whole new body. And so then they'd have that next life, and they were long-lived anyway. And they also knew eternity. So they knew that if they were destroyed by an accident, if that body was destroyed by an accident, it did not destroy their consciousness, right? So they were aware of this, and they imparted this to the Dogon, that when we created you, we're because of this affront that we happened to cause to Earth, we're giving you not only eternity, but we're making you aware that you have eternity. And they did it because they screwed up, okay? The Nummo created four breeding pair of beings. Now, bear in mind, the Nummo are basically female. The whole species is female, but then they become, within themselves, become male at the time they need to fertilize. They're mammalian-like, but not really mammals. They do have live birth, so they're oviparous. Or viviparous, and they do have some other characteristics they share, but they don't have mammalian glands, and they don't have internal organs the same way we do. But they created us, the original four breeding pair, according to the story, were created as in their image, and these beings were, we'll have to use a word that's inappropriate, but I'll use it anyway, and they're hermaphrodite, okay? So they could be either sex as they chose. And two of these beings fell in love with each other and procreated when they were both male. And this was something that the Nummo said you shouldn't do. And it drove one of them crazy. And this crazy one got into one of the Nummo's spaceship. Now, the Nummo are interesting because they actually can go through interstellar space like a sun. And they do it with a thing called a liquid copper engine, where they would literally have a liquid copper out in front of their ship that with this device that pulled them through interstellar space. And so they looked like a sun or a comet as they were flying around. Anyway, one of these ships took off. The being didn't get very far, and he brought it down, and it crashed on the Earth, and it polluted Earth for who knows how long in a deadly, deadly way with this liquid copper stuff. Killed most of the life on the planet. And then Nummo felt very bad about it, and so they went away, brought back stuff to cleanse the Earth, and they did this cleansing in a great inundation, the greatest flood that had ever been seen. And so these flood myths come down from the Nummo cleansing the Earth. They basically came down and covered the whole planet with some kind of a chemical to some level of depth and expunged the stuff they'd done, and then they set about rebuilding life on the planet because they had screwed it up. You know, it was their fault. They had to fix it. And in the process of fixing it, they ended up creating all of us. Now, in the Dogon myth of all of this, they talk about why this occurred, okay? So they have a greater depth of it. The Salish up here don't go into the why, but they have that same myth about the man who changed everything and how the very first thing that he did was to create Raven, and Raven was allowed to walk along and see all the other stuff that was going on. And so Raven is our expositor in these tales of the Changer, and that's what Raven called the Nummo, as the Changer. And the Changer was aquatic and said about, Raven was the first land creature, but the Changer created salmon, whale, and all of these others, and, you know, the water mammals and the near mammals, and then did the same on land. And so the myth is the same back and forth, although those Salish don't go into why, but they knew it was from a debt, that there was a debt involved. And so it's really an interesting tale about how we ended up where we are. And we see it replicated even in Göbekli Tepe in the constructions there that they uncovered. All of those statues are all about a genetic manipulation that ends up creating humans, you know, horses and pigs and cats and dogs and all of these kind of things as well.
It's so phenomenal as we come to understand what is actually being said there, mm-hmm. You know, because it's a story.
It's a book. Yeah. Yeah. So it's just fascinating. And so that's basically the creation myth, insofar as the Dogon have, and I think it's probably the closest thing we've got to an understanding of what actually occurred. Now, maybe the deep state and the, you know, the people that they're fronting for, maybe they know more than we do. And maybe there's more in Antarctica to discover.